Welcome to Inside Track. Santa Aurelia LLC is solely responsible for its content. The views and opinions expressed on Inside Track are those of the host and guests, and not necessarily endorsed by KVOI or its advertisers, but they should be. And now, here's Bruce Ash.
Hello, Insiders, and a very pleasant sunny afternoon to you wherever you may be. This is Bruce Ash, back from the garden, along with co-host Eb Wilkinson, welcoming you to a special 146th anniversary of the telephone's invention edition of Inside Track. Wow, how we've progressed in just about a century and a half. Who amongst us could live without our phone and the jillions of things they do for us? Who amongst us, though, finds themselves addicted to their phones and sometimes wants to throw them into the trash barrel?
Sometimes.
Yeah, welcome back. Yeah, that's right, welcome back. Yeah. So, Eb, do you know what the first words spoken on the telephone were?
Watson, come here, I want you.
I need you.
Oh, I need you. Sorry.
Same difference. Yeah. We're still using the phone. You know, it's just an amazing device. Are you an iPhone guy or an Android guy?
Android.
Man.
Hey, I upgraded from a flip phone last year, and I'm getting ready to go back to the flip phone.
Oh, God. Oh, right. Whatever. Thanks very much, Eb, for filling in last week with Tom Danahy while I was working in the garden in Coronado. I got lots of delphiniums and foxglove and dahlias and everything planted. They're getting ready for the big show there in April. It certainly was an entertaining show you guys had. Thanks to Danahy's weekly foil, Al. He was an interesting fellow. I pictured Al as being rather large.
Absolutely the opposite.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely the opposite.
Well, that shows you, you know, how much you know from looking at people on the radio. Everybody, we have a great show for you again this afternoon. Mark Lauder, Director of Strategic Communications for the 2020 Trump reelect team and former Presidential Special Assistant and former Press Secretary for Vice President Pence. The 2020 election is getting interesting, and he'll tell us all about the latest news. We'll also learn about the brave P-38 Lightning fighter pilots who fought in the Pacific skies of World War II. Our guest, John Bruning, is going to tell us about his best-selling book, Race of Aces. It's a great book. Wow, what a week. Joe Biden back from the dead. I guess it ain't over until it's over. Hey, how about Biden's sister, his wife, Jill? Maybe she gets on a security detail later on. Bloomberg drops out of his vanity run for president after dropping about $750 million. By the way, for those of you who can do the math, that's $2 to every American, not $1 million. Donna Brazile tells RNC chair Ronna McDaniel, go to hell. Likely Donna Brazile will make it there herself soon. At least I hope so. Enthusiasm and primary vote counts for Trump reelect very high, although you'll never read that anywhere. Campaign raises $86 million last month, over $600 million. That's over $600 million in the last year. Chuck Schumer threatens the Supreme Court and the Article III independence of our courts. Not a good week for the Democrats. 10-year bond rates under 1%. Stock market up, down, and all around. February job numbers up through the roof, beating all estimates. Mitt Romney says he'd protect Hunter Biden from a Senate subpoena. He's dropping like a rock, that boy Mitster. Can you say one and done? The big Satan China sending Uyghur slaves to work for Apple. That is one thing. That's one reason I might switch to an Android phone. Mark Meadows, the Trump chief of staff, announced today. Mick Mulvaney, off to Northern Ireland as the envoy there. Mike Pence, leading federal response on coronavirus. Chances of picking up virus here, very low, according to Pima County Health Department as well as Arizona Health Department. And did you know daylight saving time starts early tomorrow? Except here in Arizona, Hawaii, and some of our Pacific territories. That'll do it for Inside Track News for the past week. We very much hope you will support all of our Inside Track sponsors, Eb Wilkinson and Gary Imus at Imus Wilkinson Asset Management, Jamie and Carrie Kipper at Tucson Iron and Metal Retail, and the folks at Corazon Cabinets, Joy and David and Allie. Each has been with Inside Track from the start. These are great companies you should do business with. I really do mean what I say. I do business with each of them. Speaking of great local companies you should do business with, Corzon Cabinets is your locally owned wholesale one-stop source for high-quality kitchen, bath, and office cabinets, as well as designer services. Do you have a home improvement project planned for the upcoming year? Corzon sells quality J&K, Yorktown, and Conestoga cabinets. They offer a wealth of design resources for your home. Call Corzon Cabinets at 488-2266 and schedule a visit to the showroom. It's an easy number to remember, 488-2266. Tell Joy or Allie you heard this ad with Bruce and Eb on Inside Track and get an additional 5% discount on their already low wholesale prices. John, let's go ahead and take our first break. When we come back, Eb and I will talk with Race of Aces author. He wrote that book, author John Bruning. We invite your calls at 790-2040. We got loads to talk about. You're listening to Inside Track. We'll be right back.
Come play and discover at Children's Museum Oro Valley. Specially sized for kids 0 to 5 years old, Children's Museum Oro Valley gives our youngest visitors the chance to explore and learn in a cozy, comfortable space filled with sensory exhibits that help build fine motor skills, foster a love of reading, and jumpstart their creativity and imagination. Children's Museum Oro Valley is in the Steampunk Village Shops on Oracle Road. Visit cmorovalley.com for more information.
As you know, I advertise restaurants where I eat and recommend services my family and I use ourselves. Our money issues are handled by Imus Wilkinson, 3561 East Sunrise, 777-1911. Most folks need a good financial advisor for more than one reason. Here's one of the best ones. They'll keep you from doing really stupid things with your investments and property. Remember when it seemed lots of people planned to get rich borrowing money on their house so they could buy another one? It's now called the housing bubble. I have friends, as do you, who lost their homes playing that game who would have been saved by decent financial advice like you get from Imus Wilkinson. They'll keep you from doing dumb stuff. They also can help you do smart things. And Imus Wilkinson doesn't make anything by churning your investments like too many others in the business do. They make money when you make money. Give them a call today at 777-1911. That's an easy number for most of this audience, 777-1911, and get an appointment to have Imus Wilkinson see if they can help you like they helped my family and many others.
Customers come first at Tucson Iron and Metal Surplus.
My main goal is to make everything easy for the customer, whether every decision I make in terms of business is, will this make sense for the customer, and is this make it easier for the customer to come and look at material, how the yard is organized, what material we cover, what material we offer, anything like that.
Tucson Iron and Metal Surplus. Call 209-1579. Stop by the yard, 701 East 36th Street. Open Monday through Saturday.
Welcome back to Inside Track. Eb and Bruce here. Our guest to the bottom of the hour is author John Bruning, who in this 75th anniversary year of the surrender of Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan has written another great World War II book, Race of Aces, World War II's Elite Airmen and the Epic Battle to Become Master of the Sky. John Bruning is the author or co-author of 22 nonfiction books, including 4 New York Times bestsellers and 7 national bestsellers, including Indestructible, Outlaw Platoon with Sean Parnell, and House to House with David Bellavia. In 2011, John received a Thomas Jefferson Award for his photojournalism and reporting in Afghanistan during the surge in 2010, as well as his National Guard unit duty after Hurricane Katrina. John also has a blog, which I highly recommend you go to, theamericanwarrior.com, which is quite extraordinary. We'll discuss that a bit later. Welcome to Inside Track. Authors have interesting ways, John, to research books they're writing. How did you research Race of Aces, World War II's Elite Airmen, and the Epic Battle to Become the Master of the Sky? Was your process different from others?
I think a little bit, yeah. And thank you, Bruce, for that introduction. I really appreciate it, and it's a real honor to be on the show.
Thanks. Thanks for being here.
The research actually goes back to 1990 when I was in grad school. That's when it started. I was actually working for a company at the time, part-time, called Dynamics, Inc., and we made computer flight simulators. and I had helped research the game Red Baron, and I had convinced our team leader, Damon Sly, to take a crack at the Pacific War. So I was doing research on aces of the Pacific and discovered that we had one of the top aces who had been a University of Oregon student. And I had read about him as a kid and was always amazed by him. So I went and tracked down his family, and that was Gerald Johnson, and ended up writing my master's thesis about him. And then you mentioned my time in Afghanistan in 2010. I was in kind of a precarious situation for a little while. I was in a helicopter that started to smoke unexpectedly, and we made a precautionary landing in the middle of nowhere in the Hindu Kush. And while we were down on the ground, I kind of made a bucket list of books that I wanted to write in my head. And one of those was Indestructible, and Race of Aces is the second one on the bucket list. So I really just feel so grateful to have the opportunity to knock those two down. And I've got a few more on the list. And when Hachette allowed me to go forward with Race of Aces, I jumped in my GTO, and I spent 157 days in 2017 on the road, hopscotching around the country from archive to museum to archive to the grave sites of the families and the aviators I wrote about. And I went from Seattle to the Pentagon building.
Your story,
GTO.
Your story, how you did this in the GTO, and the GTO's prior owner is another great story as well. But how you photographed all of these documents, and how you pieced all of this together, it's just an incredible process. I mean, I'm always amazed by authors and how they research books, and this was really a feat.
Thank you. It was a little overwhelming, and I think I learned a lot from Indestructible. Because back in the day, before the internet and before you could scan documents or take photos of them with a digital camera, you had to be really picky and choosy about what you were getting at the archives. And with Indestructible, that changed. I could go in and, with my Canon DSLR, take 3,500 snapshots of documents a day. So I came back from those two trips with literally tens of thousands of documents, and I organized them into PDF files that then I could search. And the name search and the keyword search turned out to be an incredibly helpful function to wade through all of this documentation. And it was through those techniques that I found a lot of new information that had been missed in previous books and in my own research earlier in the 90s when I was working on another book about these guys, Jungle Ace.
So Americans over the age of 50 or so might have learned about Captain Eddie Rickenbacker and his World War I air ace exploits when they were growing up. I did, and I'm a little over 50. Most under 50, I suspect, only associate the name Rickenbacker with a 10-string guitar. So few know about Richard Bong, Tommy McGuire, Neil Kirby, Charles McDonald, and Gerald Johnson, as you mentioned before. What did you learn about their bravery and devotion to service that just makes these men so special and the subject of this book?
Wow, that is an incredible question. Thank you, Bruce. I think that the most important thing I learned was that when you dig deep into this country's psyche and capabilities, we have tremendous grit. We have people who can stand in a whirlwind and rise to any occasion if they're given the opportunity. And time after time after time, you see that in the darkest hours of this nation's history, enough good men and women step forward to right the ship and move us forward. And these are these five guys that I wrote about in Race of Aces are very, very much a product of that American DNA.
Hmm. Now, you're going to be in Tucson next week at the Tucson Festival of Books. I know next Saturday from 2:30 to 3:30 in Kofler, 218, talking about the bonds forged in battle. And Sunday between 10 and 12 on the U of A Big Mall tent, speaking about tactics and secrets. Have you been to the Tucson Festival of Books before?
I have not, and unfortunately, we had a family emergency come up, and I've had to back out of the
festival,
which just really, really broke my heart. I had to sit down. I had a long talk with the family. I had a long talk with the Hachette publicist and the Hachette group, my agent, and I made the decision that, to pull out, which I am really, really, really bummed about, because this has always been a lifetime desire of mine to be a part of that festival. So unfortunately, I won't be there this year, but hopefully next year.
So it was P-38 pilots who downed the aircraft that was ferrying Japanese Admiral Yamamoto and one of his vice admirals as well. What was it about the P-38 that made it such a lethal killing machine? It's my favorite airplane of the Second World War. I mean, I'll tell you that.
Mine too. Absolutely.
So what was it that made it so lethal?
So the P-38 is a remarkably special aircraft. It's very unusual. It's the only truly successful twin-engine aircraft fighter design from World War II. And the Germans had one in the – actually two in the Messerschmitt 110 and the Messerschmitt 410. The Japanese had the Ki-45 Toryu, which the P-38 destroyed in New Guinea. The difference was the P-38 had so many different benefits to it, one of which was the firepower was all concentrated in the nose. So it created a cone of fire that could just prove incredibly lethal against the Japanese aircraft that were lighter construction and didn't have the kind of armor plating that our aircraft had. So that was a key factor. Having the second engine in a place like the Pacific, where you're flying over long stretches of open ocean, turned out to be a real benefit too, because that one engine, if it went out, it didn't mean you were suddenly stuck in the jungle or trying to get into a life raft. You could actually get home. And so the P-38 brought a lot of people home that otherwise would have ended up lost at sea or somewhere in the jungle. The other asset it had was tremendous speed. It could outclimb most aircraft. It couldn't climb as steeply as some of the Japanese aircraft, but at a 20-degree or less climb, it could go and go skyward a lot quicker than pretty much anything in the air at the time. So it had a remarkable amount of performance, and it was never going to be as maneuverable as the Japanese fighters or really even the German fighters, but they could compensate that with compensate for that with the tactics they employed, which was hit and run style tactics, where they dive down, use the plane's incredible diving speed. They'd hit a formation of Japanese planes and then use the climbing speed or climbing abilities plus the extra speed from the dive to get out of the way before the Japanese could react. And that was incredibly successful all through the war.
My co-host here, Eb Wilkinson, is a former, actually, you're never a former Marine.
Never former, Bruce.
But he was a Marine aviator, and we've talked about your book a great deal. Eb, your questions for John.
John, so I've got a fondness for the P-38 only because of the twin tail, the twin booms.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Tell me why they exist on the P-38.
So the reason for that was the P-38 embodied a whole bunch of new technology, and one of the most important components was the twin turbo superchargers that the aircraft had. And in order to fit the turbo superchargers to each engine, they had to create that fork-tailed design. So if you look at the booms on the P-38, they're largely there for the turbo superchargers. And what that did was it gave the P-38 unparalleled high-altitude performance. It could outperform anything except maybe a P-47 at high altitudes, like above 25,000 feet. So that was the reason for it. It actually made it difficult to bail out of, because a lot of times the horizontal stabilizer would get in the way as a pilot was going out, and they would get hit by it. So there was a lot of concern about how do you really bail out of a P-38. It made it tricky. But
carefully.
It made for a very distinctive signature in the air. I mean, when you see a P-38 today, you know what it is. There's no misidentifying it.
So last week here in Tucson, we had what they call Heritage Days, And the P-38 flew along with a P-47 and a P-51 and a F-22 Raptor in formation, in a diamond formation, all through the Tucson skies. And I was about, 100 feet or so from the lightning when it took off. And, you know, the plane is so elegant, okay? But there was a nickname for the P-38, wasn't it? Was a
Fork-tailed devil.
Fork-tailed devil it's actually a product of the post-war era. We've done a lot of research into, did the Germans really call it the fork-tailed devil? Martin Kaden came up with that and coined it, and it stuck, and it became part of a lexicon. But that, it really is what the airplane was. But it's also like the legend that the Corsair was called the Whistling Death by the Japanese. That was another post-war concoction. Or it may have been a wartime concoction of Chance Vought, you know, from the advertisements they had. But, the aircraft was greatly feared by our enemy pilots back then, especially the Japanese, because they really had nothing that could counter it. When you have an airplane that's faster than yours, can climb better and dive better, you're in trouble.
It was also fairly quiet.
Yes. You know, it's surprising. You've seen them. You've stood on the tarmac, and you've seen them fly overhead. They have a very, very different engine signature.
Smoother.
But, boy, when you get one in a dive at high speed and the pilot's got the throttles open and he roars right down at low altitude like Dick Bong did in San Anselmo, California, that got him grounded, you can scare the hell out of a civilian.
So now, John, the beauty of the P-38, the reason I have such a fondness for it is in the Marine Corps, I was on the OV-10 Bronco.
Oh, yeah, right. Great.
Another twin boom tailed.
Yep. Yeah, definitely. Amazing aircraft in its own right. And by the way, Ed, thank you for your service.
Honored to serve.
You know, the OV-10 guys, were you doing spotting and liaison?
Yeah, I was one of those guys that sadly missed the sandbox. I got out in December of 86. I tried to get back in and had to stand in line with 35,000 others. But
oh my God.
I have friends that were over there. I've got a couple of friends that were shot down.
Oh, my God.
So the book that you've written, Race of Aces, isn't really just about the airplane. It's about, it focuses on these five men. And there was so much frenzy, and, they had these tremendous air kill totals. How did their fame and frenzy impact these flyers?
Oh, I think that's a major theme in the book. It affected each one differently, but the brass ring that they were all kind of chasing at various levels of obsession, if you will, was to become the ace of aces or top gun for the U.S. in World War II. And there was a lot of things at stake there, movie contracts, book deals, national fame and national acclaim. They all received the national fame. The press followed the race very closely. There was a box score in a lot of newspapers at least once a week, so you could track your favorite ace just like you could, track your favorite baseball player's stats. But the human effect of this was profound, and at the same time, the guys had a real outsized effect on not just national morale, but on the morale in the Fifth Air Force, because when they first started fighting the Japanese in New Guinea, the Japanese had more experienced pilots. They had better aircraft. The U.S. was in a very precarious defensive position, and we lost a lot of pilots in those circumstances, and morale was very low. And when General Kenney took over the Fifth Air Force, his first priority was to instill a true fighting spirit into the Fifth Air Force. And these pilots went a long way to doing that. The thing with aces is an ace is a pilot who shoots five or more airplanes down. And 3% of all fighter pilots achieve that. But of those 3%, they shoot down about 45% of all the aircraft from World War II that were lost in air-to-air combat. And that's pretty much across the board. So they have, the ACEs have an outsized effect on any air campaign that they were in. And these guys all became, for the most part, except for one, became incredible fighter leaders. And it was their leadership that helped infuse that fighting spirit that General Kenny needed. And so they go on to command fighter groups and fighter squadrons within the 5th Air Force that become among the top scoring units in Air Force history.
So you describe your writing as not so much a career, but a monastic calling. Did that have anything to do with that helicopter putting down, in the middle of nowhere, probably with bad guys nearby? Is that part of the monastic calling? You had a chance to do something good like this?
I once lost a girlfriend in high school or college, Bruce, because I said I didn't care about money. All I wanted to do was write history, and I'd live in a cave to do it. I think
she must have been related to some of my girlfriends.
Yeah,
it's a weeding out process.
Yeah, I guess so. I think that the writing process for me, I have to invest myself 100%. I get so into these guys' lives, not just with Race of Aces, but with Indestructible, with writing with Sean Parnell and Outlaw Platoon. Sean's running for Congress in Pennsylvania, by the way.
Right.
That I become very, very attached to whoever I'm writing about or with. And to do that connection justice, I have to just completely shut the rest of my life down and focus when I'm writing the book. So I go to a little cabin in the woods up in the Cascade Mountains that's 4 miles from the nearest human being. I take my cat that likes to swim and my Jordanian rescue dog, who was rescued by an Apache gunship pilot who pretty much saved my life in Afghanistan. And I take my animals. I go up there with food and water and my laptop, and I write nonstop.
Now, we're going to have to end it here, and we never got to the AmericanWarrior.com. With your permission, John, I'd like to try to set something up with you in the not-too-distant future to talk about that that website, because it has many great stories there as well. You're a super interesting guy. Race of Aces can be found on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, many bookstores around the country. I highly encourage you to take a look at it and read it. It's a great story. It's a true story, and that's what makes it so compelling. So, John, thanks very much for being on the show today, and hope to have you on back again soon. So until then, insiders, we've got to go ahead and take our bottom of the hour break. When we come back, we'll hear, I hope, from Trump 2020 Director of Strategic Communications, Mark Lauder. You're listening Inside Track. Thanks, John. We'll be right back.
Customers come first at Tucson Iron and Metal Surplus.
What other kind of customers do you have?
So our biggest customers are actually like ranchers and people from outside of the Tucson area. They're buying a lot of square tubing. They're buying a lot of stuff for their ranch to close off fences.
We'll sell anything from 10 feet to 10,000 feet to somebody that comes in, because we have new steel and surplus steel from steel mills. The reason we're able to get such good pricing on some of this stuff is, A, we sell scrap to the mill. So we have a relationship there, and then we can buy material what they're making, bringing it back. And so we save on freight, and we have relationships for years with them. So I think that's really our niche market. We'll sell whatever you need.
Tucson Iron and Metal Surplus. Call 209-1579. Stop by the yard, 701 East 36th Street. Open Monday through Saturday.
Primus Wilkinson Investments, 777-1911, is a unique investment management firm. They pay little attention to where the market indicators are because smart investment management goes way beyond checking stock exchanges. They are very good at managing all types of investment based on client expectations. They build relationships, and they want clients, not customers. My family is proudly included among them, and they'll help you, as they did us, design a portfolio that achieves what you want when you need it. Primus Wilkinson Investments, they're really good at what they do. 777-1911.
If you like sitting around the porch or dinner table sharing stories with friends, that's what we like to do here at Our American Stories. I'm Lee Habib, and each weeknight we bring to you stories about American love, funny stories about first jobs, this day in history, American dreamers and marriages, and even the stories of music and acting legends. I invite you to sit around the porch with us as we share Our American Stories.
Evenings from 7 to 9 on 1030 The Voice, Tucson's trusted local news and talk. Business, politics, education, and more. It's trusted local news and talk for the weekend on 1030 The Voice.
Welcome back to Inside Track. Our guest for most of the remainder of our show today is Mark Lauder, former senior advisor to the president, Vice President Mike Pence's press secretary, and currently Trump 2020 Director of Strategic Communications. A little history, Mark. The very first event, even right after the 2016 convention for nominee Mike Pence, was right here in Tucson. It was my honor to introduce him. We're old friends, to a packed house at the Fox Theater downtown. You served with Mike for some time. Can you describe the man you've known and worked with from the inside for us, our listeners?
Well, Bruce, I got to be honest with you. The man that you see, whether he's standing next to the president or behind the White House podium now as the head of the coronavirus task force, mm-hmm. is the man he is in real life. He is unbelievably committed to public service, his family, to his faith, and what you see on television and in those interviews is really who he is.
He's very warm, isn't he?
Unbelievably. Got a great sense of humor. I wish he'd let it out a little bit more from time to time, but I understand how that is. But no, he's absolutely, he's so genuine, and he has such a deep commitment to not only our country, but obviously to his faith and to his family. It's really remarkable.
Yeah. You're a Hoosier. One of my colleagues at the RNC and my attorney when I served as chair of the Standing Committee on Rules for 6 years is Jim Bopp. I've worked with many Hoosiers over the years at the RNC. John Hammond is the current co-chair of that same committee today. There's lots of great folks from your state, like your former governor, Mitch Daniels, a pretty smart guy. You got lots of them from Indiana, don't you?
We absolutely do, probably more than we deserve. I had the honor of serving as Mitch Daniels' first press secretary on his campaign and in his office when he was governor of the state of Indiana, and it was an honor. He is still one of the brightest men that I can say that I know, and what great work he's doing in the world of higher education as president of Purdue University. Held tuition down for now, I think it was 7 or 8 years in a row.
$9,997 or something like that.
Told the bureaucracy in higher education that they can learn to do more with less, much as many families have to do.
There was a big article in The Atlantic about him.
Yeah, that's my co-host, Ab Wilkinson, Mark. Hey, it appears to be...
Graduate of Purdue, by the way, Bruce.
That's right, I forgot. You would know. It appears, Mark, to be a two-man race for the Democrat-Socialist nomination. The president doesn't care which one it'll be. What would the difference be in approach, considering both Sanders and Biden have raised their hands for nearly all of the same things?
Well, it really wouldn't be that much different because they, as you said, they have both raised their hands and endorsed the same radical policies, which I think are just out of touch with where the American people are, whether it's trillions of dollars in tax increases, free health care for on the taxpayer's dime for illegal immigrants. They want to end energy jobs. I mean, Joe Biden has even gone so far as to say they should learn to code. I mean, these are radical policies. And then when you think about it, I mean, Joe Biden just earlier this week stood next to Beto O'Rourke and said that he was going to have him in charge of his gun control policy. Beto O'Rourke believes police should go door to door and confiscate people's guns. There is no such thing as a moderate in the Democrat field, and both of these two candidates are just as radical as the other.
As Director of Strategic Communications in the campaign, the role you're going to play to impact the outcome of the election is pretty significant. How would you, how do you stand up to that challenge? You've done a lot of different things in your career. This is maybe the biggest thing you've ever done.
Well, it is, and it's an honor to be able to work for the President of the United States. It was an honor to serve in the White House and now on the campaign. But in a way, it's actually one of the easiest because he also has such a record of results that we have never seen before. And there's a reason why, and I get it. I know why the media is covering the results from the Democrat primary on Super Tuesday. That's what they should do. But when you look at what happened on the Republican side, President Trump got more votes than any incumbent president, going back even before Ronald Reagan, in places like New Hampshire prior to Super Tuesday, and then in the Super Tuesday states, one after the other, he is setting voting records. And what that means to me, it really says something when people are willing to take time out of their lives or away from work to go stand in line and cast a ballot in a race that's already been decided. That says something about the amount of energy and enthusiasm Americans have for this president. And with his record of results, he makes it easy for me every day and also challenges me to do better.
You know, what you just reported on is something that I'm glad you brought it up. I actually had it as a question later for you. You've checked that one off my list. But you're not hearing that anywhere, hardly, that he did achieve that that success. And it just goes to show, and I've said this for a while, and a fellow who is sort of a frequent guest on the show, a fellow by the name of Tom Danahy, who's left of Lenin, I think, has said that I'm crazy. I say that there will be more African-Americans, more Latinos, and as an American Jew, I think I can say this, and more Jews who will vote for this president for the things that he's accomplished over the past 38 months. Do you agree?
Absolutely, not without question. And the reason why is because this is the first president we have had on the Republican side who's been willing to go into those traditionally Democrat voting blocks and say, you have been misled. You have been lied to by the Democrat Party, who says they care about you and your issues only when there's an election around the corner. This is a president who wants to deliver results, whether there's an election or not. And so you can see it, whether it is the lowest unemployment rate in history for Black Americans, for Hispanic and Latino Americans, or when we deal with the issues confronting the challenges internationally of folks who are aligned against Israel. And the fact, let's not forget that Joe Biden, Barack Obama gave billions of dollars on pallets of cash to Iran, which they turned around and then used to commit terror primarily against Israel. These are facts that cannot be disputed. And I see it when I travel the country, and I'm all over the country all the time for this campaign. People come out to me, whether they're Black Americans, whether they're Jewish Americans, whether they're Latino Americans, they all do the same thing. They look around to make sure that no one can hear them. They tell me, I may not be able to put on a red MAGA hat yet, but I'm going to do the one thing I can do, and that's vote for this president in November.
One of the things that you said is very important. Not only does President Trump say, you have been misled, you have been lied to, he shows them how. And the Democrats don't like that.
No, he's breaking through their mystique. He is breaking through, and he is blowing apart every single voting block that they have, whether it is Black Americans, whether it's Jewish Americans, Hispanic and Latino Americans, or even labor union members.
Right.
I know their leaders are all going to do the same thing they've always done, pledge undying allegiance to the Democrat Party. But when it comes to the rank-and-file folks out there, the folks that are just living their lives, and they think about the politics when it comes time to go into the election booth, they see the results. They see people in their families, themselves, and their communities doing better because of this president. And they have told me on time and time again that they're going to vote for this president.
Mark, the president told an interesting story a few weeks ago when we met down in Florida for the RNC winter meetings. And he talked about the report that he got from Bill Stefian late in the afternoon on the 2016 election. Bill calls him first and he says, oh, I'm not sure we're going to win. The exit polls don't look good. Actually, I take that back. Jared Kushner told him that. And then later, Jared talked with Bill, and Bill came back and said, no, I think we're going to win. And the reason we're going to win is because all of the people who've told us that they weren't going to tell us how to vote or how they voted, they did it with such intensity where I'm absolutely convinced they voted for Donald Trump. Matt Schlapp came and talked with us just a couple of weeks ago also, and he commented how people talk like this to their friends. They don't want to admit that they're Trump supporters, but they plan to vote for him. I mean, it's amazing what's going on in this country.
And the difference between 2016 and 2020 is that while we still have a very large percentage of people that do that, more and more people are happy to come out now and say, I'm doing it openly, because there is that record of success. And we've got to be honest, and one of the things that we talk about often on this campaign is when you're running in a challenger or an open seat race, you're asking voters to take a leap of faith for right. you. That if you vote for them, they're going to deliver on these promises. And people took a chance. They took that leap of faith. But now this is a president that can point back to saying, I delivered. Whether it was renegotiating the horrible NAFTA deal that Joe Biden supported, whether it was standing tough against China, whether it was doing something that every president and every presidential candidate of both parties has said for the last 25 years about moving the embassy in Israel mm-hmm. to Jerusalem, it was the law. They all said they were going to do it, and they got in office and got scared and didn't do it. This is a president who delivers on those promises, and now people are feeling more and more comfortable that they can say, I'm going to vote for this president. And even though I live, you know, right outside of the swamp here in D.C., I can wear my Trump jacket that shows where I work and where I proudly support, and I get more people coming up to me and just kind of giving me a little bump and going, I support your guy, than I do people who want to stand up and join Maxine Waters in calling me out.
So there are some things a president can control and others that only God knows what the outcome is going to be. Your former boss, Mike Pence, as we talked about, is in charge of our national effort to protect America and really the world from the dangerous problem the virus presents. What progress can you report on the virus and kind of where things are going today?
Well, I think the first thing we need to do is we need to recognize that the president took decisive early leadership to help contain the spread of the virus. And he was mocked when he restricted travel from China, from mm-hmm. those infected areas, back to the United States. And the media and the Democrats were the first ones to jump on board. But because he took that strong step, we have not seen the spread that we have seen in other countries. Now, there's no question about it. We are going to continue to see an increase of numbers of people who have been infected with the coronavirus. But the one thing we also know true is that the risk for the average American is extremely low. And while those who are getting up there in terms of their age, those who have pre-existing medical conditions are more vulnerable, the average American out there who's living their lives should continue to live their lives, because this is really basically just a case of the flu. You're going to recover, and we have seen that time and time again.
So what's the balance in the messaging between communication that looks as though we're in a malaise and communication that you know appears that we're in chaos? It seems like a very difficult balance to make, and how are you making that?
Well, it's always a balance, and we have to remember that, you know, one of the things that we can talk about, obviously we had a tremendous jobs report again yesterday, right. that the fundamentals of the American economy are strong. The fundamentals of our strength as a nation are unbelievably strong. We have the strongest military, and it is getting stronger. We have the strongest economy, and it is getting stronger. Are there, of course, challenges? Yes, there are, of course, challenges. We live in a difficult world. So we can talk about those challenges and how the president is working to protect Americans, whether it is economically or in terms of our relations overseas. But we're doing it from a position of strength and not a position of weakness, which is what we have seen under the Obama administration, what Joe Biden wants to go back to, where we outsource our leadership in the world to the salons and parlors of Europe and what other international organizations think we should do. This is a president who's going to do what's best for our country, first and foremost, always.
So President Trump's a fighter. I love his tweets, and he's well-positioned himself in the middle of almost every issue and success over the past 38 months. Now, some of my friends tell me, assuming my pay grade would allow me the privilege to talk to the president about this, but they say, tell him to stop tweeting. I think, personally, he must continue tweeting. You're involved with strategic communications. What do you hear people say about tweets, and can we expect more as the election heats up?
Well, I think, you know, look, the first thing we need to recognize is that every president in our history has sought to be able to talk directly to the American people. I mean, my goodness, Abraham Lincoln and his allies bought newspapers. FDR's fireside chats were not about calming a nation on the verge of war. It was about using the technology of the day to reach out directly to the American people. Kennedy and Reagan mastered the use of technology, and President Trump has mastered the use of social media. In fact, the president's social media presence has more people connected to it than watch the Super Bowl every year.
Yep.
It's the number one most watched event in television every year. Every time the president takes to social media, he communicates with more people. So that's not something he's going to give up. And I think one of the reasons why people connect with him is because he lets them know what he's thinking. And it's not polished, and it's not poll-tested,
and it's not filtered.
The sound bite. It's what he's actually thinking and going through, and he's letting the people know. So I understand that. But for the folks who, you know, take issue with some of that, then what I would say is look at the results.
Yeah,
had presidents of both parties who give great speeches and don't do anything in office.
God, that is so
right. Now we have a president who maybe uses language that not everyone would use, or only language that people are thinking in their heads and saying with their friends. But look at the results he's getting.
Well, speaking about language, Senator Schumer stepped into it this week. I'm sure you'd agree. He says he's apologized and never meant to do harm to Article 3 members of the government. He says he's apologized and never meant anything. So if you were director of his strategic communications, I realize this is a stretch, Mark. What would you tell Senator Schumer to do at this point in time about the quote from earlier this week?
Well, first and foremost, he should have obviously never said it.
Yeah.
He made a direct threat. He pointed to the Supreme Court when he named the justices Kavanaugh and Gorsuch and said that they would pay a price. And, you know, I get that term. That term is often used politically, but those two gentlemen will never face an electorate. They don't run. They're not on the ballot, and they are confirmed for life. There is no price for them to pay. So it is a direct threat. He should have not said it. And he also should, as soon as he did say it, he should have immediately clarified it. He didn't. He doubled down. And now he's going to have to face the political repercussions of what he has said, because he has done damage to the United States Senate and really crossed a line that we don't cross in our government, because the Supreme Court is above reproach in terms of that.
Joe Biden is a gaffe machine. Is Slow Joe coachable?
You know, I'm not sure you can coach a guy who actually doesn't realize what state he's in, or that Super Tuesday is on Thursday, or literally, I mean, this is the one that kind of struck me, was when he talked about negotiating the Paris Climate Accords with Deng Xiaoping from China, who left office 20 years before it and died 25 years or so before before it was signed. I mean, there are certain things you can't coach.
He wanted to be the first president to appoint the first African-American woman to the Senate.
you can't make that up. But, you know, that's who he is. They are. But I will tell you the one thing is that, look, the Democrat Party has not settled on a candidate in Joe Biden. They have settled for a candidate in Joe Biden, because Michael Bloomberg imploded. He was supposed to be their white knight to stop from Bernie Sanders. And when that blew up in their face, they had no choice but to go to Joe Biden. And now they're going to have to live with it. And I have a feeling he will go down the same path as Walter Mondale, Al Gore, John Kerry, and Hillary Clinton.
Do you think the Democrats are deliberately conspiring to keep Bernie Sanders out?
Yeah, there's no question. And to with all due respect to Donna Brazile, who may tell me where I can go, the Democrat Party changed the debate rules to allow Michael Bloomberg on a debate stage in Las Vegas and in South Carolina when he wasn't even on the ballot in those states. So you cannot make an argument that they are not doing everything they can to keep this nomination from him. And it looks like they're going to succeed, but at what cost? Because here we go again. They did it in 16. They're doing it again in 20.
So do we face a 1968 sort of scenario where the Bernie bros and some of the others who feel like they got gypped out of the nomination end up creating violent situations? And how many, maybe the more important question is, how many of those people sit home and don't vote at all?
Well, first and foremost, and I'm going to say this as a student of history and someone who practices this this profession of politics professionally, I hope it never comes to violence.
Right.
It should never come to violence. And I would hope that he would be the first one to condemn that if it, in fact, went that way. But when it comes to whether they sit at home or not, that's something they're going to have to decide because, again, not only in 16, but here again in 20, the mainstream Democrat establishment has kept your candidate and done everything they could to keep your candidate off the ballot, and they're going to have to make that decision for themselves.
The Biden and Sanders surrogates arguing on TV with one another, they sound very divided. How does the campaign capitalize on that, and do you see a fractious and divisive convention?
There's no question they're going to be having a divisive convention because the party is being torn apart right now between the communists and the not quite communist socialists because there is no moderate lane. They have to come to grips with that. And at the same time, they have to come to grips with what we were talking about earlier, is that this is a president who, through his results, is tearing apart their coalitions. Whether it is Black Americans, Hispanic and Latino Americans, or labor union members, more and more of the rank and file, more and more of the moderates are jumping ship and coming on board with this president. We see it. I mean, every one of our rallies, we have 20, 25% of the folks who are signing up are registered Democrats.
Right.
Or 20% are folks who didn't vote in 2016. He is blowing apart their coalitions. And now they're just left scrambling, trying to pick up the pieces of what's left of their party.
Yeah, no, that's a crucial point that you make, and we've certainly seen that. It's ballooned since 2016. When you look at 2016 right now in March versus 2020 in March, the operation is incredibly sophisticated, multidimensional, but at the same time. There are at least a couple of the social media platforms that have said no political advertising in the 2020 election. Is there a new strategy on social media in this upcoming election process?
Well, we'll continue to use the platforms that we are allowed to use, and in the meantime, we're also developing a new app. Where people will be able to download the app onto their phones, not only get the latest information coming out from our campaign, but also they'll be able to sign up. They'll be able to get the information to talk to their neighbors, to people at work, to people at church, and go door to door and help join the army that is going to reelect this president. He's the first one to say it's not a campaign, it's a movement, and it's a movement of people. And each and every person out there has the power within them to help bring 2, 3, 5, maybe 10, if you're out there, 10 people to the polls to support this president. Because as he told me a couple of weeks ago when I was last spoke to him, we're going to continue to fight this like we're 1 point down. We're not going to make the mistake that Hillary Clinton made. And we're going to fight for every state, every vote. And we will be victorious because of that.
Mark Lauder, thank you very much for appearing. Hopefully we can have you back on the show as the election continues. Until next week when we return with more great guests like national opinion maker George Bardmesser on Slow Joe Biden. For Inside Track, this is Bruce Ash.
And Ebb Wilkinson.
Wishing you a very pleasant good afternoon.